From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a guide to cancer therapy. Patients can choose between a number of options in conventional and alternative therapies, but the information about these options is usually ambiguous, complex, and confusing. We'll talk with Michael Lerner about his research into integrating conventional and alternative treatments. Also, Captain Rudolf Patzert tells us about his clandestine voyage after World War II, smuggling Holocaust survivors into Palestine. It's the subject of his new memoir, Running the Palestine Blockade. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Food and Drug Administration Commissioner David Kessler testified on Capitol Hill today that the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company has secretly developed a high-nicotine tobacco and started using it in U.S. cigarettes.
We now know that a tobacco company commercially developed a tobacco plant with twice the nicotine of standard flue-cured tobacco. That several million pounds of this high nicotine tobacco are currently stored in warehouses, and that this tobacco was put into cigarettes that have been sold nationwide. We now understand that several tobacco companies add ammonia compounds to cigarettes. Further, one company's document confirms that the intended purpose of this practice is to manipulate nicotine delivery to the smoker.
Kessler also testified before the House panel that he learned earlier this month that Brown and Williamson told contract researchers to lie to the FDA about the commercialization of the high-nicotine tobacco. The firm admitted to the FDA only 4 days ago that tobacco was being used in its Richland, Viceroy, and Raleigh brands. Authorities in Bristol, Pennsylvania, say a chemical explosion has rocked a plant in the northern Philadelphia suburbs. Authorities have evacuated some people and closed a stretch of Interstate 95. That's the major north-south highway along the East Coast. An emergency dispatcher says the explosion came just before noon local time. It triggered a large fire. More than 24 people have been treated for injuries. An anti-abortion activist has been charged with masterminding at least one attack at a Planned Parenthood center in Syracuse. Acid was splashed around the New York center to disrupt abortions and other medical activities. Richard Block of member station WRVO reports.
73-year-old John Arena of Rome, New York, is charged with being the motivating force behind the attack. Assistant Onondaga County District Attorney Lisa James says it was John Arena's idea. Arena paid for the attack and Arena supplied the acid. Deputy Onondaga County District Attorney William Dowling says his office takes this case very seriously.
It is not a joke. It is not a game. It is not civil disobedience. It goes to the point where it hurts individuals.
John Arena entered a plea of not guilty and was released on his own recognizance. A mother and daughter from Auburn, New York, who allegedly carried out the attack under Arena's direction, also entered not guilty pleas. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Block in Syracuse, New York.
Lori McNeil helped to make tennis history at the Wimbledon tennis tournament today. She defeated top-seeded Steffi Graf. Graf is the defending women's champ. A defending titleist has never lost in the first round before. Graf has won 5 previous Wimbledon titles. On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen 32 points to 3,709. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Los Angeles police investigating the Nicole Brown Simpson murder case say they didn't find a murder weapon in a vacant lot near Chicago's O'Hare Airport. The lot is near the hotel where O.J. Simpson checked in the night his ex-wife and a friend of hers were murdered in Los Angeles. Police say they have found a bag, sunglasses, and socks on the lot, but it's not clear if these items belong to O.J. Simpson. Representatives from Congress and large computer companies are trying to come up with a code of ethics for using computers and the information superhighway. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Industry leaders estimate that computer fraud, including hacking, software piracy, and computer viruses, carries an annual price tag of at least $20 billion. Peter Tippett, a computer security expert, says many people who would never stow away on a plane or break into someone's house think that electronic information is somehow up for grabs.
A lot of people sort of get the notion that if something is easy to do, it's also okay to do. And this fits right in with software piracy. Computers are better at copying than they are at computing. And it takes us some education from our society to teach us that just because something is easy, it's not necessarily right.
Tippett is working with industry leaders and members of Congress to come up with programs for teaching computer ethics to school children and to reach adults via computer bulletin boards. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Southern Yemen is urgently calling for international help. Officials in Aden, the southern port city, are asking the world to help end the 7-week-old Yemeni civil war. Aden authorities say heavy fighting has left 16 soldiers and 3 civilians dead. Northern authorities say more than 1,100 soldiers and officers were killed yesterday as they tried to attack Aden. The figure can't be independently confirmed. War broke out between northern and southern Yemeni troops on May 5th after 4 years of a troubled union between former North and South Yemen. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Lerner, has written a new book for people with cancer who want to understand the many choices available in conventional medicine and alternative therapies. It's called Choices in Healing. Michael Lerner is president and founder of Commonweal, a health and environmental research institute in Bolinas, California, which, among other things, runs residential support programs for people with cancer. Lerner served as a special consultant to the Office of Technology Assessment of the U.S. Congress on its study of unconventional cancer treatments. He won a 1983 MacArthur Fellowship for his work in public health. I asked Lerner about the difficulty of making an informed choice when you've just been diagnosed with cancer and haven't spent years studying the options.
There really is a science and a craft to mainstream medicine with cancer that makes sense an awful lot of the time. Unfortunately, with some of the major cancers, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and some of the others, there is an enormous range of legitimate choice for many cancer patients.
I think in the United States, there's this big division between the medical profession that uses the conventional therapies for cancer, radiation, chemotherapy, surgery, and the people who practice the alternative medicines, whether it's nutrition or homeopathy, or a more spiritual approach. And the two often don't seem to meet. I know it's your ambition to raise the level of dialogue, not only about these medicines, but between these two different groups of practitioners. What's the problem with the level of dialogue now?
I think the problem with the level of dialogue is shifting, and it's getting better. But it used to be, as you described it, that there were these two totally opposed camps. There was the conventional standard care camp, and there was the alternative holistic camp, however you wanted to describe them. And there were true believers in both sides. In the case of cancer, the true believers in standard cancer therapies regarded all the complementary therapy people as quacks, and there was nothing of value there. And it was absolutely a quack, cynical practitioner is practicing on desperate, credulous patients. And that was the way it was described for a very long time in America. And on the other side, you had the people doing complementary therapies who regarded conventional therapies as a conspiracy against the patient. You know, cut, burn, poison, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and that it was all a conspiracy to suppress these cures that were available in complementary medicine. That old dichotomy, while you still find it, people sort of lobbing shells at each other among the true believers, is breaking down. And what is replacing it is a recognition that what cancer patients really want is to integrate the best of standard therapies and complementary therapies in ways that make sense to them.
What are some examples of how you can combine conventional medical therapies with alternate therapies?
Well, the best example is the work that David Spiegel has done at Stanford University with women with metastatic breast cancer. He had one group participate in a support group, a simple support group. He didn't expect that it would extend their lives. He simply thought it would improve their quality of life. And the other group just got standard therapy. Both groups got standard therapy. 10 years after he had done this study, he just decided to look back to see what had happened to survival. And to his amazement, the women who were in the support group who had simply tried to improve their quality of life by simply talking to each other about what it was like to go through this and learning a few things about relaxation. He used a hypnotic technique. That they had double the survival of the women who only had standard therapies. Well, this sent a shockwave through the world of what's called psycho-oncology, psychological approaches to cancer. And what it did was retrospectively legitimize a whole field of research that had been done with less well-designed studies, where people had been finding more or less the same thing, which was that psychological interventions were not a cure for metastatic breast cancer. But people had an intuition that people who participated in support groups, which they found meaningful or did psychological work, seemed to do better. If it had been a new chemotherapy that had doubled survival with metastatic breast cancer, this would have been major headlines across the country and around the world. But because it was something as inexpensive and simple as a mind-body approach, while it got some headlines, it got, in our biomedically oriented culture, it got nowhere near the emphasis that it deserved. It is not getting to this day the level of research support that it would have gotten had it been a chemotherapy. From my point of view, that's bad public policy.
Your perspective now seems to be in emphasizing the use of conventional medical therapies along with supplemental, less conventional therapies like a mind-body type approach or nutritional therapy. But you make the point, don't try to convince people who aren't interested in alternative therapies that they should be. Don't try to convince your 70-year-old mother that she should try a macrobiotic diet for her cancer. Why not?
Because we don't know enough. My basic finding, having looked at complementary therapies around the world for over 12 years, is first of all, there is no cure for cancer that I have seen among the complementary therapies. Secondly, there's very little scientific evidence on which to evaluate the really interesting question, which is, do these contribute, not to cure, but do these contribute to extended survival as a median thing, the way a new chemotherapy or a new radiation might contribute to extended survival? At best, perhaps they prevent recurrence. If they prevented recurrence, that would be an enormously important thing. Think of all the young women, age 35, with two young children who develop breast cancer. They have a lumpectomy. They have conventional treatment. And then they have to live the rest of their lives worrying about recurrence. Well, it is an enormously important matter of public policy whether psychological, nutritional, and other complementary approaches lower the incidence of recurrence for breast cancer. We don't know the answer to that. That research is still not being done in any significant way.
But I think this relates to another point you make, too, which is that different people seem to do well with different kinds of therapies. And there seems to be almost a correlation between your personality and the kind of therapy that's going to work best for you. Why is that? I mean, we think of, with most therapies, that a medicine either works or it doesn't work.
Well, we don't know the answer to that either, for sure, but here are some thoughts about it. The basic thought is the linkage between the fact that when you're doing a lifestyle therapy, it matters enormously whether that therapy makes sense to you, because the whole idea is that that therapy reinvigorates you spiritually, psychologically, nutritionally, physically, whatever level of well-being it's working on. So if you, let's say again, are a young woman with a woman in her 30s or 40s with breast cancer, and for you, you are really drawn to prayer, to a support group, to macrobiotic diet, to yoga or tai chi or qigong or whatever the practices are that attract you, to traditional Chinese medicine and so on, then in addition to whatever unknown or partially known specific benefits those therapies may have, the fact that it engages you, the fact that you are making choices that make sense to you, probably reduces stress, and stress is a known tumor enhancer, particularly in animal models, probably in human models as well, probably enhances immune function, does all kinds of good things if it makes sense. Whereas if, by contrast, say you are a 70-year-old woman with breast cancer who's always enjoyed her way of life, you know, say classical music and, a diet with fish and meat and so on, and you develop this cancer and your son or daughter is pushing on you the same things that would make sense to the daughter or son, For you, these may be arduous, foreign, unhelpful approaches that you would only take on if you really had some certainty that for you it would really make a difference in your life. And so we don't know enough to recommend them. But my point is that we do know enough to say that the evidence on a lot of these things, while by no means certain, is very intriguing. It's very provocative. And 10 or 15 years from now, we may know enough about some of them to recommend them as useful adjuncts to standard medical care.
I just want to pass on some, I think, really interesting advice you give in your book, which is that if your 70-year-old mother has cancer and she's not into macrobiotics, instead of trying to force her to change her diet, visit her more often. That will probably do a lot more good.
Yeah, truly so. And in fact, that came from a young man who was actually a practitioner of macrobiotics who had a mother with cancer. And he was talking about how difficult it was for her to get her to go into this, which he was so committed to. And I said to him, you know, it might be helpful if you just went home more often. And later he called me and said, you know, that was really helpful advice.
I'm sure you learned a lot about cancer and its effect on a person and that person's family when your father, the writer Max Lerner, had cancer. And he was 77 when he got cancer. And what kind of cancer was it?
He was diagnosed first with a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and following that with prostate cancer metastatic to the lung. Metastatic means it's extended, traveled to the lung. Prostate cancer metastatic to the lung is supposed to be a very, very poor prognosis. As you know, he lived for another 12 years to die at the age of 89. Both those cancers went into remission. He died of a completely different cancer. And I started this work because of him. I wanted to see if there was something I could find that would be of value to him.
When he was diagnosed with cancer, he was given, what, 6 months to live, I think?
It was unclear, but it was not a good prognosis. It was, a year, 6 months to a year, or maybe a little more. But they were not hopeful.
One of the questions was, should he get, was it radiation or chemotherapy?
Chemotherapy.
Chemotherapy. And, mm-hmm. and you were basically recommending against it.
I was recommending that he do whatever made sense to him, mm-hmm. but my own gut feeling was that given what I was hearing from the physician about the prognosis, it seemed to me that the sort of risk-benefit analysis was not great for the chemotherapy, and that had I been him, I would have chosen quality of life and probably not to do the chemotherapy. Now, as it turned out, the chemotherapy was enormously effective dealing with the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and put it into lasting remission. It didn't come back. So, what I learned from my father, and it confirmed what I really most deeply believe, is there is no single right way to do this. And in fact, what I started looking at complementary therapies to see if there'd be something of value to my father. He never used any of the complementary therapies I researched. And he believed that the chemotherapy offered him the best hope. So he took the chemo, and he went through a very difficult chemotherapy. He lost a lot of weight. He aged 10, 15 years. He'd been a very robust, vital 77-year-old man, and in a short period of time, he grew much, much older. But the chemotherapy was part of what saved his life.
Michael Lerner is my guest. He's written a new book called Choices in Healing. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Lerner, the author of the new book, Choices in Healing. Have you found that a lot of mainstream doctors will feel comfortable with patients who, in addition to taking the chemo or the radiation therapy, decide to take a nutritional approach or emphasize some, you know, mind-body type of therapy? Because you say to patients in your book, you say, If you're using an unconventional approach in addition to a conventional approach, something that you're very comfortable with, make sure you tell your doctor about it. No, but I'm wondering if the doctor is going to tell you if you want to do it, fine. But personally, I think there's absolutely no reason to believe that's going to help you.
That's probably a pretty common response that doctors have. And I actually don't have too much difficulty with a doctor saying that, as long as he's saying, if you want to do it, fine. Mm-hmm. And if that, if you want to do it, fine, is based on a real assessment on his part that this probably isn't going to do you any harm. But I think that doctors who are open to this, and I really do believe there are more and more of them, if you just take psychological support groups, psychological support groups are now pandemic in healthcare, mainstream health systems across the United States. There are support groups for every kind of cancer in many, many mainstream centers. That's a change. It's come about because of patient demand. So I think the doctors are changing because the patients are changing, and the medical marketplace is driven by demand.
Are there any generalizations you can make about which alternative therapies hold the most hope and which you think might make big claims but really can't back them up?
Well, I did some work with the Office of Technology Assessment for the U.S. Congress on their big report called Unconventional Cancer Treatments. And they used parts of a typology that I developed of looking at the thousands of complementary cancer therapies around the world, but the dozens or low hundreds that are most common. And the typology I developed was that you can distinguish between spiritual approaches, psychological approaches, nutritional approaches, physical approaches, traditional medicines like traditional Chinese medicine, and then on to a second tier, pharmacological approaches, herbal approaches, electromagnetic approaches, and so on, 10 or 12 categories. My point of view is that the top four, the spiritual, psychological, nutritional, and physical approaches, they are a quartet of approaches that, if you just think about it, if somebody is right with themselves and their spiritual life, is psychologically healthy, is eating well, and has a physical program that makes sense, what happens? They become healthier people. So if someone does that intensively with cancer, you become a healthier person with cancer. Well, any doctor would prefer to do surgery on or chemotherapy or radiation on a healthier person. And in fact, there's a lot of scientific research indicating that with many cancers, that a higher level of what they call functional status, which means being healthy, is a predictor of survival.
What about that second tier that you mentioned?
The second tier is where more of the problems are. And the greatest problems are with the pharmacological therapies, the pills. Basically, the spiritual, psychological, nutritional, and physical, those tend to be open therapies. All the information's on the table, and it's pretty obvious whether it makes sense to you or not to eat a certain way, to pray, to go to a support group, whatever. Those are open ethical systems on the whole. There can be some questions. But as soon as something becomes a pill, it becomes very susceptible to abuse. You can sell it for a lot of money. It doesn't have any intrinsic, obvious health-promoting capacities. And so it is in the area of pharmacological therapies that the greatest abuses take place.
And would you include certain, say, vitamin therapies in that too?
That's a marginal point. I mean, not marginal point, it's a marginal case. But I would include vitamin therapies in that category because...
suspect category.
As I say, it's on the margin.
Right.
There is real research that the antioxidant vitamins C, E, A, and also selenium really do have... in lab tests and so forth, beneficial effects on controlling some cancers. On the other hand, when they're turned into pills and mass marketed, they're not being eaten as part of the whole food. We don't know all the concomitants in the food that account for their epidemiological results. So to me, that's a kind of a middle place. It's not as suspect as some of the real, there are some doctors or practitioners who say, I have a cure for cancer or a way of controlling cancer. It's a secret. And if you come to my clinic and pay me thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, I may be able to cure or control your cancer. And that's where the real abuse takes place. That's where the heavy-duty abuse can take place.
I think there are some alternative therapies that tell you that they have to be used instead of surgery or instead of chemotherapy, that chemotherapy would be so powerful it would counteract the benefits of this nutritional program or this homeopathic program or whatever. And I wonder if you have any advice about how to sort through a decision like that when it's an either-or thing and not something you can do in conjunction with a conventional therapy.
Well, my point of view is that where the evidence is right now, there's really strong scientific evidence that describes what conventional therapy can do in a specific situation. If there is an available conventional therapy that is curative at a high level of certainty, so that if you do this therapy, you are very likely to be cured, then I would absolutely choose the conventional therapy over the complementary therapy that said it had to be done exclusively. But suppose somebody has a metastatic recurrent cancer where there is no cure in conventional therapy, and suppose that they are being urged on the one hand to start chemotherapy or so forth right away as a palliative thing to make it better, and on the other hand, they are interested in some complementary therapy that that interests them. I think there the choices are more personal, because there isn't a clear cure available in conventional therapy, and the radiation or chemo is being offered as a palliative therapy. What does palliative mean? It literally means it will make it better, right? Or it will reduce the, you know, it will reduce the suffering. Well, if in the person's personal experience, he or she believes that his suffering or her suffering will not be made better by starting that chemotherapy right away, that instead they want to, doesn't have to be a complementary therapy, they may want to travel, or they may want to spend time playing the cello or whatever it is, or they do want to try a diet or try whatever it is, then I think that's a much more complex and much more personal choice. But if there's a curative therapy available from standard medicine, I myself have an absolute priority for that over any complementary therapy. And I personally believe that most of the time you can integrate the best of both worlds in a less exclusive way.
Michael Lerner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Lerner's new book is called Choices in Healing. He's the president of Commonweal, a health and environmental research institute in Bolinas, California. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After World War II, Captain Rudolf Patzer took on a clandestine mission to smuggle Holocaust survivors into Palestine. He was given a rundown converted gunboat and an inexperienced crew. His ship was captured by the British, who set up a blockade of Palestine to prevent illegal immigration. Coming up, Captain Patzer tells us the story. It's the subject of his new book, Running the Palestine Blockade. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Jane Hamilton's new novel, A Map of the World. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hospital workers in Spokane, Washington, continue to treat victims from a mass shooting at Fairchild Air Force Base yesterday. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports.
Four people were killed and 19 wounded by a former airman at the base. 20-year-old Dean Melberg, formerly of Lansing, Michigan, was then shot and killed by military police. Spokane County Police say Melberg was discharged from the Air Force for psychological reasons. One of the first people he killed was the psychiatrist who had recommended his discharge. Police say Melberg arrived at the hospital in a taxi cab with an assault rifle and a non-automatic weapon hidden in a duffel bag. Melberg then entered a restroom, took out the gun, went into the office of the psychiatrist, and started shooting. From there, he headed down a series of hallways, spraying bullets through the hospital and annex, and at one point killing a bystander in a parking lot. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
A Virginia State Appeals Court has unanimously awarded custody of a lesbian's 2-year-old son to her today. The court reversed a judge's ruling that Sharon Bottoms' relationship with her female lover made her an unfit parent. The decision is likely to be appealed to the state Supreme Court. The appellate judges rejected the judge's findings that homosexual acts in Virginia should disqualify a lesbian as a parent. The U.S. dollar plunged to an all-time low against the Japanese yen today. It also showed considerable weakness against European currencies. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
Just in time for the tourist season, the dollar fell below 100 yen for the first time ever, hit year lows against the German mark, and also slid against other major currencies. Americans traveling abroad this summer will find their dollars buy fewer units of foreign currency when they go to the bank and, consequently, will pay more for everything. Likewise, imports will cost more, while exports will tend to cheapen. Around midday, the dollar fell to 99.85 yen, eclipsing the previous low of 100.4 yen per dollar set last August, and the greenback fell to below 1.59 marks per dollar. There was no official comment and no action to support the dollar from the Treasury Department, which is responsible for dollar policy. And contrary to speculation, there was no indication from the Federal Reserve that it is ready to raise interest rates again to bolster the dollar. The buck's weakness triggered a stock and bond sell-off on Wall Street. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
The Commerce Department says the U.S. trade deficit jumped 22% in April to $8.4 billion. Analysts say the gap between imports and exports was bigger than expected. On Wall Street, concerns about rising interest rates sent stock prices sharply lower for the third straight session today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 34 points to close at 3,708.29. Declines swamped advances by a 4-to-1 margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton says the United States is asking North Korea to confirm that it's ready to freeze its nuclear program. The president says he expects to know in a few days. He wants to confirm the North's assurances to former President Jimmy Carter, who visited Pyongyang last week. One U.S. official says the State Department has mailed a letter to Pyongyang. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is handing out the first group of buyout checks to residents of Valmire, Illinois. The town was totally destroyed during last summer's Midwest flooding. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports from Valmire.
Buyout checks from the federal government are being handed out to 37 Valmire, Illinois families whose homes were virtually wiped out by last summer's floodwaters. Coordinator of the federal relocation effort, Larry Zensinger, says the buyouts are similar to a normal real estate deal.
We get the previous owner to execute a deed transferring title to the property to the United States government in exchange for whatever we've decided is the agreed upon purchase price. So that's the transaction.
Valmire was the first community that voted to relocate after the flood. Two-thirds of the village of 800 will use their buyout money to buy a home in the new town on the bluff. Eventually, FEMA expects to buy out about 8,000 properties in the Midwest floodplain at an estimated cost of $500 million. I'm Kathy Lohr reporting.
An American teenager who was caned in Singapore for vandalism has been released from a Singapore prison today. Michael Fay told Israeli radio today that his confession to the crime in Singapore was beaten out of him. He says some of his friends were hurt worse than he was. Fay spent 83 days in prison after his conviction. Fay's case generated interest in Israel because he's the grandson of a Holocaust survivor. Fay says he shook hands with the man who lashed him with a rattan cane, saying the man was only following orders. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest played a role in a part of history that was popularized by the book and movie Exodus. After World War II, many Jewish Holocaust survivors in Europe had no place to go and ended up in overcrowded camps for displaced persons. Israel didn't yet exist. At the time, Palestine was under British rule, and the British had strict limitations on immigration. The British had a naval blockade to prevent refugees from entering Palestine. But the Haganah tried to break the blockade with dozens of boats carrying thousands of Jewish refugees seeking sanctuary. The Haganah was the underground military of the Jews of Palestine. Rudolf Patzert had worked in the Merchant Marines during World War II. In 1947, he became the captain of the Paducah, whose clandestine mission was to smuggle nearly 1,500 Jewish refugees from Bulgaria into Palestine. His commander was Mocha Lyman of the Haganah. His ship was a small, run-down, converted gunboat. I asked Captain Patzert if he believed all his passengers would fit.
I didn't think so, but the Haganah people, Mocha said, we've been doing this, and it'll have to fit. Well, I said, it's pretty dangerous. Well, he said, if you knew the conditions of the camps and how they were living, if they didn't have the possibility to make this trip, why, thousands of other ones would lose faith, too, because it was the only hope they had to get out of Europe and out of the camps, these little ships. So he said he would show me how they could load it all.
So you had to squeeze a lot of people in. People probably came with whatever belongings they had left in the world. How did you board them onto the ship? Maybe you could describe what that night was like.
It was dark. We had a cone of lights, cluster lights, onto the gangways. We had four gangways out to our ship. And it was a quiet. I still remember the quiet. You could hear the sounds of the water draining from the ship's discharges and all. Then the first ones came into view. And they were very small children. It was the orphans that came first. 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, barely able to walk, some of them. And had all different kinds of clothing. They had a bundle, like little bundles. They were as wide as they were tall. Old caps and old hats over their heads. And these kids come up. And when he came up to the gangway, I had my sailors there. And the sailors, it was a very emotional thing. They would grab the kids who had trouble walking up the little gangway. And they would carry them into the ship. And take him into the special bunks. Everything was prepared on the ship for the small children. We parted to keep him as close to the deck as possible, whether we get fresh air and perhaps a little sunshine when we are out at sea.
What kind of condition were the adults in when they boarded?
The kids were, like I described, and after the first tiny ones was about the teenagers, 12, 14-year-olds, and these in Cyprus. Not in Cyprus, but in the camps they'd been in Europe, where they'd been taught songs, been able to do things to take care of themselves. So these kids were inspiring. They came down the dock singing Hatikva. It was the first time I'd heard that the Jewish song of hope. And then there was some older people. We had mostly children, orphans, and some older people. And these all trudged along, come up. It was a terrible sight of their conditions, battered and all, not physically, but from hunger and from depression, and there were things of the war done to them. And then we saw a little gang of very tough kids, 18, 19, 20-year-olds. I asked Namoka, who are these kids? He said, these are our wild kids. They got escaped from camps, and they survived in Europe, in a very bad Europe there. They robbed and did very rough things there to keep alive. And it was sort of cynical of us, too, then, at this stage. So what Mocha did, my Haganah commander, he gave him responsibilities. I still remember when he looked at him, the way they looked back at him, a little bit contemptuous, questioning where his authority was and all. But they worked out very well.
Do you think that the Jewish people who boarded your ship had any idea of how likely it was that the ship was going to be captured?
I think they expected anything, and it was in the news about the British campaign and the British Navy, so they had a good idea that perhaps they would end up in another camp, which is what happened.
What were your plans about what you were going to do if you were captured?
It was funny. If you know that you're going to be captured, you look over the charts and figure, what can you do about it? And we knew that we would end up on Cyprus. So I was looking at that map of Cyprus, seeing how far it was from the nearest land, was any place on the island itself we could escape to, the little knowledge we had. And really, I really accepted the fact that I would be captured and be put in a camp on Cyprus.
How were you captured?
We were about 12 miles off the coast of Haifa, and the British had four destroyers then, big ones, and they had been prepared. They had built the pipe structure, the platforms that were higher than our rails. So Mocha, he got angry there because we had been orders not to resist because we had so many old people and children. And he was angry because he wanted to resist. The Haganah all through on the fight on every occasion, no more supinely giving in passively. So he said, let's go down the coast a little ways. So I told the wheelsman, all right, parallel the coast, turn and give it, change a different course, and we'll go and see what happens. So we were outside the 12-mile limit, but the British were not for caring about niceties, so the destroyers charged. I heard Sholo and the bosun say, here they come, and they hit us. They charged us, rammed us from two sides. And when they rammed into us and the ship was shaking and rolling while the paratroopers dropped from these platforms onto our deck, and I saw some sailors shooting hoses at us, I thought it was going to be high-pressure water, but it was tear gas. So they took care of it. We didn't fight. They took over the ship very quickly. And we knew that the Exodus and the previous ships had been captured. The British had sailed them back to Germany, where they made the Germans take the people there. So we figured we're not going to let them do it with this ship. So I'd ordered the engineers, as soon as the destroyers hit us, to dismantle the engines, our engines, so they couldn't be used again. Use welders' torches and all, cut port lines, and they did that. So we were dead in the water, and the British took us over.
When the British took over your ship, you pretended that you were a Jewish refugee instead of an American captain of this ship. So you took a Jewish name, you changed into refugee clothes, you pretended you didn't speak English. Why did you pretend to be one of the Jews? What was the thinking behind that?
It was a camouflage. We didn't want the British to identify us and select us and arrest us. So we mixed with the people so they couldn't find us.
How would you have been punished if they knew you were the captain?
Well, they were talking in that time. British were trying to get the Americans to prosecute American captains who were doing this and give them 4 or 5 years in the penitentiary to punish them.
My guest is Captain Rudolf Patzert. He's written a memoir called Running the Palestine Blockade. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Captain Rudolf Patzert, author of the new memoir, Running the Palestine Blockade. So you ended up spending 2 years in a detention camp with the Jewish refugees who were on your ship. This was a refugee camp in Cyprus that had been built for German prisoners of war. What was the camp like?
The camp was terrible. It was barbed wires, had the watchtowers, and the British soldiers were not bad, except that they were bored to death. It was a terrible job they had there. And they were anti-Semitic, and they blamed the Jews for this position. The food was terrible. The vegetables that came in were pretty rotten at that stage. And the camps were surrounded by latrines, so you were never outside the smell of the latrines. And the condition of the people were bad when they came in. After all these camps they'd been through, and the fact that they were survivors, to go into another camp when they'd been so close to Palestine, it was an added blow to them. It really knocked them out. And so we were there about 3 months, and then the Haganah wanted to get us out. The British, under the white paper, allowed 750 people a month to go proceed to Palestine legally. They would give them a certificate. So what the Haganah did was they had some people who were there, had been there for a year, 2 years, surrender their passport that the British had given to the sailors. So I took on a different name then, and I took this old man's passport. And the way they had moved us, the Jewish...
Let me just explain here. The Haganah wanted the crew to be able to get to Palestine. So the Haganah asked some of the people who were eligible as refugees to actually get there. They asked them to give you their passports.
Right.
After you were able to go to Palestine, your adventure actually continued. You were told that you would be taken first by the British to a Haifa prison camp, and then after about 2 months you would be interrogated before you were released. Now let's remember you were still passing here as a Jewish refugee. So if they interrogated you as a Jewish refugee, you might have had a hard time
exactly
figuring out what to tell them. So you knew you'd be better off if you escaped.
Right.
And you managed to escape.
I did.
How did you do it?
Well, what happened was Boca was told by buddy there, he said, prepare yourself. Now you're going to get rid of all the foreign Polish and Romanian clothes. We'll give you Palestinian clothes, short khaki pants, khaki shirt. And if there's any opportunity, when this ship unloads at the docks at Haifa, well, you make a break for it. Try to escape. So we were headed outside of Haifa, and we were in the air part of town when I saw my bus driver, an old man. He ran the bus into the bus ahead real hard. Then he threw open the doors and he said in German, geht weg, you know, scram. So I took off right away and the rest of us did, and I had 3 members of my crew who were with me. But I figured I would get outside their lines, the British lines, and try to control the situation, and I did. And I met one of my second mate who was a little further up ahead of me. And so we kept walking into town, into the Jewish part of town, and the way we got picked up, I went into a little Jewish watchmaker's place, and I told him in English, we just escaped the British, and we have to get off the streets right away. So he didn't say a word. He put his hat down, took the loop out of his eye, and took us down the street to the community center. And he took us up there, and they took care of us right away. They gave us a sandwich, gave us a glass of milk. They made a telephone call, and about 10 minutes, a big car came with Haganah men in it. So they picked us up and took us to one of the finest big hotels in Haifa. It was owned by the trade union movement, the History of Truth. And they put us there, and in about an hour, they took us out, took us to a clothing store, outfitted us in clothes, had our pictures taken for new passports, and a different name again. So that's the way we were picked up.
Do you know if any of the people who were on board your ship and then were detained by the British ever made it to Palestine?
Oh, they did. The camps were opened a year and a half after the British left. They still kept them in the camps in Palestine. Then the camps were opened, and the Jews had us, Palestinians, now the Israelis, had to transport them. But they all arrived in Palestine, everybody.
Did any of the ships trying to get to Palestine actually make it through?
Earlier small ships, quite a number of them, ran up on the beach at night. They would follow the coast around, and the British didn't have the amount of navy there to keep the surveillance, and they did make it. They would run up on the beach. The people would jump into the water. Then people from shore would pick them up in trucks and cars and motorcycles and disperse them around the countryside and into kibbutz and into the cities. But at our stage of the game, it was after the Exodus, the big battle of the Exodus, and the 10 American ships. There were 10 American ships that brought in around 60,000 people. At that stage, the Navy had everything closed down.
I'm curious if you ever saw the movie Exodus.
Yeah, I saw that.
What'd you think of it?
I was very disappointed when I saw it. It was a romantic light, and I thought it would have some of the images that we had during the trip, the people as they actually were, the kind of villains that the British played. It was an old empire trying to hold on, and they played a very bad role, and it wasn't colorful. I know it's the Israelis liked it because it brought them a lot of support and all. But I really remember how my spirits dropped when I saw Exodus.
What are some of the images that stayed in your mind that you hoped to see in the movie and didn't?
Oh, the children, the condition of the children. And like on Cyprus, the people who were fighting among themselves, it was no nice cooperative thing. I remember they had high mortality rates among the mothers on Cyprus. So the Haganah tried to set some tin huts where they would be better protected against the weather, cold rain and winds and dust and dirt. And they set aside some tin huts for the mothers. So some people from the Exodus who'd been heroic and fought the British so hard, some Romanian Jews, they fought and took the huts away from the mothers. Stuff like this, people in this survival, it was a very rough deal. And this thing to stay alive.
Do you have any regrets that you participated in this, as it turns out, futile attempt to break the British blockade again and get to Palestine?
No, it's one of the great things of my life. It had been preceded by 4 years of war, where I spent in the North Atlantic and in the English Channel and the Mediterranean, where all sorts of tremendous things happened and all. But this was dimmed by this one voyage, by getting these people, giving them hope, and participating in their struggle to get to Palestine. And it was amazing and very satisfying experience. I'm very close to all my crew still today.
Captain, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Captain Rudolf Patzert has written a new memoir called Running the Palestine Blockade. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing about testimony on Capitol Hill today that the tobacco industry did develop a higher nicotine content tobacco at one point. We'll also be hearing today about prom night at Taft High School. That's the Chicago high school that Ira Glass has been checking in on throughout the school year. And a report on the controversy over Disney's America. That's the historical theme park planned for Northern Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. It's quite a controversial one. Some residents of the area oppose it. Others hope it will create jobs and develop the economy.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jane Hamilton's 1989 novel, The Book of Ruth, won the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award for Best First Novel. Her second novel, A Map of the World, has just been published. And critic Maureen Corrigan says it may well be the novel of the summer, as long as you don't want your summer reading to be restful and reassuring.
Lots of people are comparing Jane Hamilton's A Map of the World to disturbing novels like Sue Miller's The Good Mother and Jane Smiley's A Thousand Acres. Like those stories, A Map of the World chronicles the collapse of a woman's life because of one single slip-up. I second those comparisons to Miller and Smiley, but I think Hamilton's writing may be even more awesome. I'm using that word not the way the kids use it, but in its original meaning, referring to something that inspires wonder, respect, and dread. As I was reading A Map of the World, images from the Puritan sermons of Jonathan Edwards kept springing to mind, and thankfully that doesn't happen very often. In Edwards' most famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, he declares, "God holds us over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider over the fire." Hamilton's novel evokes that very same mood of existential panic. As the story opens, a pair of heavenly scissors have just snipped the thread tethering our heroine, Alice Goodwin, to her normal life, and she begins the long free fall of the damned. Alice commits her fateful sin in the first chapter, so I'm not giving much away when I tell you what it is. One summer morning, Alice, who lives on a Midwestern dairy farm, is minding her own children and a friend's two daughters. They're all about to go for a swim in the nearby pond when Alice gets distracted for 5, maybe 10 minutes, just long enough for her friend's two-year-old, named Lizzie, to toddle out the door into the pond and drown. Here's Alice's nightmare vision of Lizzie's last moments. She tried to grab hold of the water, pawing for the metal bar, a ladder rung, her mother, but there was nothing. She opened her mouth to cry, "Mama!" Her lungs filled with water and she sank. Maybe she saw the great white light and felt the intoxicating warmth of God, like some say happens before death. She sank. The trout in the pond swam along through the dark water. They noticed Lizzie out of the corner of their eyes. After the ordeal of the funeral, Alice descends into depression. Hamilton describes this faint gray sleep so precisely, she sometimes made me feel almost too drained to hold her novel in my hands. Then further disasters strike: a drought, plummeting crop prices, child abuse accusations, and finally, imprisonment. Alice welcomes each successive catastrophe as a means toward paying her pound of flesh for Lizzie's death. I was pretty skeptical of the by now overused child abuse plot, but A Map of the World reminded me that all it takes to make a subject fresh again is exquisite writing. Hamilton here subverts our favorite national myth. She tells us that there are no second chances and that fate is largely out of our control. In fact, Hamilton's message echoes those gloomy gospels of predestination that Jonathan Edwards once preached. And I guarantee you, just like some modern-day spellbound pilgrim, you'll hang on Hamilton's every word.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Map of the World by Jane Hamilton. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Lerner about integrating conventional and alternative cancer therapies. Lerner was featured in Bill Moyer's Healing and the Mind series. Lerner's new book, Choices in Healing, is intended to help people with cancer understand their options in treatment. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.